Recorded live.
Hello, everyone. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review at Jurnov, and welcome to the first 2011 show of ESI Bytes. Happy New Year, everyone. ESI Bytes is where we offer information from national speakers on electronic discovery at a price everyone can afford, which is free, and available when they're interested in listening to it, which is whenever you download it, put it on your iPod, your iPhone, whatever, and decide to actually listen to it. So today we have a show on electronic discovery, which focuses on when administrative agencies are requesting ESI. And this is a show which Allison Stanton and I talked about doing for, I think it was much of 2010. And the only holdup was Allison had intrigued me by saying she was going to recruit a participant from the DOJ to join the podcast. Then in October, Allison joined the Department of Justice, which, of course, changed the to-do list before we could record the program. Now all I had to do was get on Allison's calendar, which wasn't that easy, and ask a good friend, Chris Danick, to join the program in the role Allison was going to play. So before we start the show, let me introduce the panelists. Allison Stanton is the Director of eDiscovery for the Civil Division of the U.S. Department of Justice. Among her responsibilities, Allison develops eDiscovery policies, practices, and training for the Civil Division, works with the other Department of Justice divisions on eDiscovery initiatives, advises federal agencies on eDiscovery matters, and provides guidance on proposed changes to procedural rules, regulations, and legislation affecting electronic discovery. Prior to joining the Department of Justice, Allison was an attorney with Hogan Lovells, U.S. LLP, where she represented numerous clients on complex civil cases and high-profile criminal investigations, many of which included complex e-discovery issues. She also developed proactive e-discovery plans for Fortune 500 companies, including document retention policies and litigation hold and response procedures. In addition, Allison is the vice chair and 2011 chair-elect of the D.C. Bar e-discovery committee. She's an established author and has spoken at national and international e-discovery conferences. Lastly, Allison has been a tremendous assistant in developing and helping to develop a website for law students that we've worked on together called www.lawblogreview.org, which we hope will launch later in January. Allison, thanks for joining us. Christopher Danig, the other panelist, is of counsel in the Covington Burlings, Washington, D.C. office and is a member of their litigation, white-collar defense, investigations, and SEC Enforcement, International eDiscovery, and Foreign Corrupt Practices Act groups. His practice focuses on representing clients in complex federal civil litigation, including class actions, internal corporate investigations, government investigations, congressional investigations, and compliance matters. Chris has been extensively involved in several high-profile corporate investigations, including representing special committees of independent board members of Tyco International, Adelphia Communications Corporation, and other major corporations. He's also handled numerous investigations involving FCPA on behalf of companies and individuals, provided transactional due diligence advice, and designed FCPA compliance programs for clients. Chris also has extensive experience handling FCPA investigations in Europe and Asia, including working closely with foreign lawyers and accountants, as well as dealing with local laws and data privacy concerns. In addition, he's represented companies and individuals in DOJ, SEC, OFAC, and NYSE investigations. He has also served as counsel to a court-appointed receiver in an SEC proceeding and has successfully represented criminal defendants in felony cases in Maryland courts. Great, Chris, thanks for joining us as well. First of all, before we start, I always like to ask how you each got involved in eDiscovery. Allison, you want to start, and then Chris?
Sure. Thanks again, Carl, for having us. It's a really important topic, and I know it's a fantastic opportunity for your listeners to get a little bit of insight on what goes on the government's involved in cases.
Well, although I should add, these are your personal views as well as Chris's. They're not the views of the organization. It's just providing a little bit of insight here, trying to help.
That's correct. So the way I got involved in electronic discovery was very early on in working in complex cases, pretty much complex white-collar criminal investigations, and really finding an opportunity and a space, if you will, for people to really understand both how the law and technology could help move along the substance and the merits of the strategy that you're developing in a case, and really found an interest in that merging of technology and the law and how fast technology really could impact and change the efficiency of your advocacy. So started pretty much early on as an associate and just grew from there and got very involved and interested in speaking with other people in the field, finding you, Carl, of course, and really just in enjoying seeing how there is this birth, if you will, of a brand new area of law. Electronic discovery is a substantive area of law and a substantive area of practice, and it is not very often in our history that we actually do see something like that growing. And it's also interesting to think about how law traditionally does not move necessarily very fast when it is then confronted with technology, which, as we know, changes almost by the minute, by the second around these days. It's interesting to be involved in that process of thinking of creative ideas and how to merge the two. So pretty early on in my practice, and then just growing and nurturing that interest. When I would encourage people to do the same, is to find something that really seems to be a unique spin on something and really get passionate about it and really engage and see and find the community out there.
Boy, I would love to take that little clip and send that to the 120 law schools still that aren't teaching e-discovery.
Right.
They don't recognize it as a substantive area of law, but that's fantastic. Chris, how about yourself?
Very, very similar experience to what Allison just said. I also do most of my work in the area of complex white-collar criminal cases, and having an expertise in e-discovery is just absolutely critical in that area. And Allison hit the nail on the head with the idea that this is an important substantive area of the law. I think up until the last few years, a lot of people have thought about the discovery process, and e-discovery is kind of something you have to get through before you get to the substance. Nothing could be further from the truth. It's a critical area, and especially in today's economic climate, it's an area with a lot of costs that companies have to deal with, and their lawyers, by bringing some expertise to the table, coming up with efficient ways to deal with these issues and these large volumes of information and documents that you have to deal with, can bring a lot of value to the clients. So I think, to be an effective and a top-notch white-collar practitioner, or to do complex civil litigation, you really have to have an expertise in the e-discovery area. And as Allison said, it's also just been fascinating to keep up with the changing technology and see how that works in this law industry that we're in, that is a little bit conservative and doesn't always move as quickly as some other industries do with embracing new technology, frankly.
You'll get an amen to that. So Allison, let's start briefly, if you could describe the process of government investigation sort of generally and how ESI plays into the process.
Sure. A couple things to keep in mind. The government will wind up being involved in litigation in a couple different ways. One is when they are spearheading an affirmative litigation. If there is, for example, a healthcare fraud investigation, or if there's an agency that's specifically looking into a subject matter area and they do have litigation authority, for example, the FTC or the SEC, when they can actually investigate and do have statutory authority to do so. At the Department of Justice, there are several different divisions, basically organized around subject matter area. For example, there's the Antitrust Division, which speaks for itself, the Civil Rights Division, the Civil Division, the Criminal Division, and they all do a variety of different things. The Civil Division, which is the division that I'm the Director of Electronic Discovery for, we handle cases in which we are both investigating in an affirmative way, healthcare fraud, for example, banking fraud, and other cases where we are representing agencies. We are, in essence, they're not technically acting as outside counsel for an agency, for example, U.S. Department of Agriculture or the EPA. So you'll find cases where the United States is involved both as an affirmative plaintiff in a straight-up traditional civil case. You'll find them involved when it's actually an investigation that could be both a civil investigation. We have the authority to have civil subpoenas, civil investigative demands as well. And then as a potential defendant when the government has been sued, and then the Department of Justice is involved in helping defend the agency. So electronic discovery and electronically stored information come into play in a couple different ways in each of those different scenarios. Where we obviously are investigating, parties should expect to see those requests in the form of a subpoena, could be in the form of a search warrant in some cases, or a CID, which is the civil investigative demand. And those usually have instructions and definitions as part of those documents that explain when they talk about the subject matter areas that are involved in receiving information. They also want it in a certain format, certain way, and that pretty much starts laying the groundwork and the conversation between the parties. In the traditional civil litigation context, you'll have the complaint, the answer, you know, the motions practice, and the different requests for production of documents and the corresponding objections that would go for that. In both cases, you're really finding that the government is getting more and more sophisticated in the types of information that they're requesting and the understanding that they have of the technology that is out there. And understanding that, for example, when we say we want all the emails to and from these two parties, you know, two potential individuals involved, that means not just the to and from email, but anything they were BCC'd and CC'd on, anything that they would have in their private email accounts, not necessarily just their company accounts. And there's a growing understanding of the technologies with information that may be stored up in the cloud when you're going after potentially a company who has a sales force, you know, looking to see what types of information they have is stored in different databases like Salesforce.com. So the information is very important because it's evidence. And I think people sometimes forget and think, okay, well, documents and data, that's just sort of the boring part of the case. It's the evidence. It's the good old-fashioned, you know, Perry Mason moment of when they, you know, whip out the letter. In this case, it may be the overhead projection of it. And point to the information and the factual underpinnings of the case. So the electronically stored information very much comes into the building blocks of the strategy and the factual development of the matter. And the government is getting more sophisticated in realizing and seeking the information from the different sources.
Great. Thanks, Allison. So I'll start with you on this one, Chris, but I'd like to hear from Allison as well. Since you both practice in the space and you see, you know, there are unique challenges maybe with working with administrative agencies, what do you see as the biggest challenges with working with administrative agencies in e-discovery?
Well, from my side of the table, there's an unequal power relationship often, especially in sort of the white collar criminal area where you're coming at something from the perspective of a government investigation. You're in a situation where the government is sending you a subpoena or a request for information. It's the beginning of the case. Often the government doesn't have, a great handle on what it's looking for yet or all the details. So you might be confronted with a rather broad set of requests for information. You could be talking about a very large volume of documents, potentially a great many custodians. And as I talked about in some of my initial remarks, you know, this could all be quite time-consuming, quite costly for companies and other clients, and they're especially sensitive to that in the economic environment that we're in right now. So it's a matter of, you know, working with the government to try to narrow the subpoena down, figure out exactly what they're looking for, and hopefully working with the government, come up with some methodology to get at the information that the government is looking for in a quick and hopefully cost-efficient manner. And you're doing this from my side of the table in a bit of an unequal power relationship. Some of the things that Allison touched on are interesting as well, in that the government is becoming much more sophisticated in this area, thanks to Allison and others, which I think is a good thing. There can be challenges on either side. If you're dealing with somebody on the other side of the table who is not very sophisticated in e-discovery areas and is asking for a great deal of information, that could be a very challenging thing to deal with. So I think we're moving in the right direction here as the government becomes more sophisticated in these areas and can effectively work with us to come up with efficient means to get the information that they're looking for.
Now, Allison, you're sitting on the other side there with some experiences. What do you see as the biggest challenges for administrative agencies in e-discovery?
Right, and I mean, obviously unable to speak on behalf of all the administrative agencies, but from it's really been very interesting. You know, I was in private practice for about eight, nine years or so, and there are a lot of really unique considerations to see on this side. You know, as sort of Chris pointed out, it's an investigation. We don't necessarily know where we're going to wind up being at the end of the day. And a lot of it comes down to, and I worked with some fantastic attorneys who were very, very good at doing this at Hogan, we're building trust. You know, obviously, and this is sort of in the investigation context as opposed to just, although actually it does apply in the traditional civil context. You know, you're working with an advocate and you're with an opponent and trying to advocate not only now for the substance and the merits of your case, but as to how they're going to go about and collect the evidence that would be the evidence of their case that they're trying to build. So, you know, one of the challenges that you have is really working with us to show that things are on the up and up. You know, that you are not trying to figure out a way of carving out those key documents by limiting your custodian list to just 10 people who wind up eventually just working in the copy room. You know, a lot of it really comes down to being upfront, building credibility, engaging early, engaging honestly, and being an advocate not only, you know, just for the merits of your argument, but for the process. And explaining as to why, you know, it's in everybody's interest to do things in a certain way. And obviously be prepared for, you know, the responses to be that to a certain degree we do have to be a little bit more expansive. And really trying to build that credibility. You can lose it in an instant, but really being very good in building that credibility. And, you know, and I had the fortune of sort of growing up with folks that were very good at that, and I see the benefits of it now on this side as to making sure the entire process goes more smoothly. It is a challenge. I mean, it's a lot for people to have to trust on, but the biggest challenge is having people move out of the gotcha game and to really sort of show and explain why it benefits everybody involved. You know, if you're up front with us and say, you know, look, it really is only this department you really need to talk about right now, and you only really need their information, we're not going to cut you off in the future from getting to anything else because, you know, obviously we don't like being cut out of that because who knows where the investigation is going to go. But, you know, let's start with this. We've done some internal due diligence. Let's start here and then move together in this process. And I think that's very important. And one of those challenges is really having folks build that trust by engaging, you know, early and honestly and educating on that process.
Well, that was a great lead-in for the next question, Allison. Chris, from an outside lawyer's perspective, and then Allison, if you want to add anything, from the agency's perspective, are agencies amenable to the cooperation proclamation? Are they responsive to working with parties to craft and limit e-discovery responses or form of production or how you look at the data?
In my experience, yes. I mean, obviously, when you're dealing with a variety of, you know, U.S. attorney's offices or SEC offices, and circumstances in particular investigations might be different, you know, things can vary from case to case and office to office. But I absolutely believe and echo what Allison was just saying in terms of cooperation. That is the best approach and the approach that you want to take. We could talk some more about this a little bit later in this podcast, but you absolutely want to be opening a dialogue with the government early, building trust, keeping the lines of communication open, and you know, working together to try to come up with a reasonable method so that the government can get the information that it wants, but do so in an efficient way that's as targeted as it could possibly be. You know, we're spending a lot of time, a lot of money, a lot of resources on this, both at the sort of the private sector level and the government. So we, you know, there is a mutual benefit to trying to work together on this. Are there going to be disagreements? Of course. I mean, it is an adversarial relationship, so cooperation, you know, from the private company or client point of view doesn't mean rolling over on issues, but it means having an open and honest dialogue with the government, trying to reach solutions and come to a mutual agreement, you know, where you can. And my experience is that you're usually able to achieve that.
Okay, and Allison, I think you may have already answered that question.
Yeah, I mean, it really does depend, you know, and I think it's one of those things where you have to realize the perspective that we're coming from. You know, our charge is to protect the public and the public fisc, and obviously we want to find the ways of getting at the information most efficiently and the right information as quickly as possible in order to do that. You know, people need to remember why we're here. We're not here to make people's lives more difficult. We are here to protect, and making sure that we are able to get the evidence that we believe will help us in that charge is important. And it comes a little bit down to you know, the subject of either that investigation or the opposing party. You know, really to explain why, you know, it's in the best interest of those involved to really try and either narrow or cooperate to get to that goal. I mean, as Chris said, it is an adversarial process, and we're not expecting, you know, folks just to open the doors, though sometimes that would be very helpful. It is something where people do need to understand the perspectives people are coming from and what our charge is. So it is helpful to keep that in mind when working with us.
You know, sort of switching gears here a little bit here and talking about education, you know, law firms, judges, and companies who know electronic discovery all share, and these are the people that know electronic discovery, obviously, all share a common issue in the field. They have tremendous problems training their peers on new techniques to advance the field of e-discovery. So, Allison, with agencies, how do you deal with that same issue?
Well, there's a lot of effort right now, and I know there has been even before I got here, underway to really sort of think about what do we need and what do the different agencies need in their own charges, because they're not all dealing with the same type of information. They're not all dealing with the same type of data, and when discovery hits for that type of information, let's say an agency is involved and has filed a complaint, but is also then on the receiving end of a document request, they have to think through what resources do they have and the capabilities they have to deal with their specific type of data. Do they have a lot of satellite information that will be relevant? Do they have a lot of complex medical records that would be involved? Do they have a lot of Medicaid information? You know, so really trying to figure out not the one size that fits all, but you know, what exactly is the type of technology that your agency needs, and then how do you do the e-discovery piece to that and the technology to that. A lot of it obviously comes down to resourcing. You know, it is not, as everybody has seen and read in the papers, it is not just the private side that has budgetary issues and concerns. And, you know, there's always the analogy of, well, what's the core business of the agency? You know, what is the core business of a company? And then how do you fit the discovery resources into that? So it's a very interesting situation to see how those resources are allotted. That said, you know, there is a lot of effort underway to figure out either with what we have, as well as with what we can either bring in house or contract in the e-discovery process. And there's a very sophisticated system that's already set up in that regard, in the contracting regard. You know, how do we train folks up to that? And then how do they work with their DOJ counsel on those issues? So there's a lot of training, and, you know, the agencies have really, quite a number of them, banded together to really get more information, not just about the law, but about the different technologies. So there's information sharing across the agencies about the different types of processes and the tools. But, you know, it's a big place. And it's the same. It's to a certain degree, there are similar challenges in making sure that the ones that are on the ground, the ones that are actually involved in the day-to-day, are the ones that are getting the information on what are some of the tools that are available, and then how to use those tools to make everybody's life easier and get the information out most efficiently.
But do you see it developing either like formally with an e-discovery guru type of a person, or even informally, like called Bill, you know, he's the one that's studying, he's the geek lawyer that's interested
right.
in this area, because it's hard to expect every lawyer to really embrace technology, even though
right.
Jeff Facciola says they should. It's just we're not wired that way.
Right, right, and I think that's the case, and I think you'll find a lot of people who say they went to law school simply to avoid all this, and once there are numbers on the screen, that's unbelievably scary. You know, I think what I've seen evolving, and once again, it's not one size fits all, I've seen where the agencies are dedicating some folks, you know, specifically to this area. Some of them in the general counsel's office of the agency, some of them in the CIO's office, and there are a number of agencies who have gotten quite sophisticated in what tools they even have in house, and it's just a question of a little bit of resourcing as well as how often they're involved in litigation. But I mean, I know I've been to several agencies already, you know, both doing training as well as just brainstorming with them. And right now what I'm seeing is when possible, they are bringing, you know, they are either bringing in or growing up and supporting specific folks who are knowledgeable in this area.
And I guess one last advocacy type of an issue, when you're working across from someone who's asking for information and it becomes obvious, as it often does if you understand e-discovery, that the other person really doesn't understand e-discovery, but they have all the power. What's your advice in that scenario? And I don't know, Chris, if you wanted to chime in on that, but it's an interesting situation. I think it happens. It's not infrequent that this happens.
Chris, you want to take that one first?
Yeah, I mean, it's again, I think having a dialogue with the person across the table at the government agency that you're dealing with, and you know, at times if you have to try to do some education of the person across the table, you have to take some time and try to do that, and that's what I was alluding to a little earlier. I mean, it can be challenging. If you are dealing with, you know, somebody who is not very sophisticated in this area and might not understand some of the challenges that are a part of what they're asking you to do. And this, I mean, you know, this can happen in private litigation as well. You know, I see the government changing, you know, folks like Allison, other people at other divisions within the Department of Justice are getting, you know, much more sophisticated. You know, there are calls that I'm now involved on where it's not just lawyer to lawyer. There are, you know, IT people from the government who are participating on the call, and then we on our side of the table might have our IT people or outside IT vendors participating on the call, so those folks can kind of speak the same language at a level that even the most sophisticated e-discovery lawyers can't. And you know, those kind of dialogues can be very helpful, but you know, there can be situations where it can be challenging, and you have to do some education and really explain in a careful way the challenges that you're facing trying to comply with a particular request.
And I think one of the, you know, important pieces of this is, like any advocacy, like any point or of persuasion that you're trying to get across to an audience, you need to be prepared. And I think, you know, sometimes it's too often that people think they can just sort of throw up that, oh, it's expensive, or oh, it's inaccessible, or oh, it would be burdensome. Tell me why. You know, you have to, you know, it's not a magic wand where people are automatically going to say, oh, okay, well, because it deals with technology, it must be hard. The opposite's happening now. I was on a panel with a judge the other day who said, look, you know, because of technology, I now actually expect things to happen faster, not slower, and things to be easier, not harder. Now, I mean, as we all know, that isn't necessarily always the case. But, you know, you need to be prepared. You need to be prepared for those conversations and to explain and know your audience and how you're explaining it, and explain in a way that it can be translated to what your audience is familiar with.
There's a nurturing side to this instead of, you know, hardcore, you know, in-your-face advocacy.
I mean, there's a little bit of both. I mean, you have to know. I mean, if you're going to be hardcore and the other person on the other side has all the cards, I mean, you can sort of guess where that one's going to go. But, you know, you really need to think it through. It's like, okay, you know, your opposing counsel, you know, does not know what a terabyte is. You know, they possibly think it's another type of dinosaur like a brontosaurus. You know, so think out how to translate it. You know, it's the good old translate to box count. You know, look, if we give you everything that you've requested, this is how many times it's going to the moon and back. And if we don't give it to you in a certain way, which is the load file that we need for our database as well, you're never going to find it. You know, you're never going to find the information you need. So let's, you know, let's do it this way. Let's talk about what are some of the main issues. And be prepared that since it's an investigation, remember, you're not going to necessarily always get the answer that you need or expect because it's an investigation. But if you can try and figure out ways of saying, okay, well, you're not going to tell us entire subject matter. All right, let's start with the U.S. as opposed to global, you know, and then move from there. But you got to know your audience, and you got to be prepared because that first conversation is going to set the tone. And if you don't know what you're talking about, or you come off looking like you're too slick, your credibility is going to really go down.
So Chris, let's jump sort of a little bit more into the weeds here, especially the being prepared, because two key differences from civil litigation are the government investigators wield a lot of power with no judge really accessible to complain to initially, and also the time frames are compressed. So with those two factors, when an investigation starts, you know, how do investigatory targets effectively start the process without feeling like they're in a Chinese fire drill?
Yeah, absolutely. That's a challenge. There is an uneven power relationship here. And you know, while you might have some situations where maybe, you know, there's a grand jury subpoena that you're dealing with where, you know, technically there is a judge who you could complain to if there's a problem, that's obviously something you don't want to do and would be a last resort or beyond a last resort. You really want to be working with the government lawyers to work things out. But aside from those situations, look, I mean, a company, a client is going to be anxious and nervous when it receives a subpoena or a request for information from the government. That's just natural. And outside counsel, you know, you have to do some initial hand-holding and counseling and you know, explaining that, you know, we're all going to get through this and we've got experience in this area and we're going to help you through it. In terms of the process with the government, you know, the way I've approached it is, you know, when a subpoena hits my desk from a client, you know, I want to do some quick due diligence with the client. I want to be talking with, you know, not only the lawyers, but, you know, some of the key business people who have substantive knowledge and then, you know, key IT people. I want to try to, you know, get a sense of the company's IT systems, you know, the volume of data or documents that we might be looking at, you know, get a rough sense of the categories of documents we might be talking about, maybe the numbers of custodians that we're talking about. Have some initial discussions perhaps about whether the company has a prior relationship with a preferred IT vendor or something like that. Just some quick due diligence. You know, then I want to make a very quick initial call to the government, you know, within a day or two of receiving the subpoena to talk with the government to show that, you know, we're on the case, the company is taking this very seriously. You know, we want to work with you. You know, we want to work through these issues. You know, all these things that Allison and I have been talking about beginning to build credibility, opening a line of communication, getting a dialogue going. You know, you might want to have some initial conversations about, you know, what's the government really looking for? I see this fairly broad subpoena. You know, what are you really looking for? You know, talk a little bit about some of the IT issues, some of the challenges that you might face, and then ask for a little more time and say, you know, I just got this. I want to talk with my client some more, get some more information, and then, you know, get back on the phone with you as quickly as I can. So maybe a few days later, a week later, whatever it is. You know, you want to get a little bit of time. You could then go back to your client, do a deeper dive on all of these issues, and then have this second, more substantive call with the government where you get into these issues in a more substantive way. And you want to, as Allison said, be prepared and have some proposals, have some suggestions that you want to put on the table. If there are some things that you think you shouldn't have to do, or there are better ways of doing it, be able to explain that in detail. Why can't you do X, Y, or Z? Why is it more efficient, better for the government to do, you know, D, E, and F? And you want to have those conversations. Who are the key custodians? Start talking about maybe a rolling production. Talk about what's the realistic timing of getting some of these issues taken care of. There might be some technical issues in the subpoena or the request for documents you want to deal with. You know, the government will often ask for native files. That could be challenging sometimes. You might want to have a talk about what kinds of documents do you really need the natives for, as opposed to just a TIFF image. And then you want to open that line of communication, make it crystal clear that you want to have a dialogue. You know, I want the government, if there's a problem, to pick up the phone and call me. I don't want to receive an email or a letter or something like that. If there's a problem, if you're not happy with something, if you're confused about something, pick up the phone, give me a call. and we'll work it out. You know, tell me what the issue is. I'll follow up and I'll get back to you. You know, there shouldn't be, as Allison said, none of this gotcha or anything. You know, let's just keep talking about it. And that's kind of the initial approach that I take, and that builds credibility, it builds trust, it builds dialogue, all of those things that you want to have with the government right from the get-go.
Does that sound like a reasonable approach, Allison?
It does, and I think one of the things to definitely make sure to keep in mind is that it's a small world, so that when you're dealing with an agency or the government in one case, don't be surprised if in the next case they know how you were and what your credibility and what your reputation is. So I think a lot of the things Chris has said is absolutely helpful, and I think the additional layer to remember on that is it's a small world. So, you know, as you're going through all that, make sure that you realize the representations and how you carry yourself really can impact future cases you would have as well.
Absolutely. I mean, just to jump in, you know, this is more obviously for the lawyers. You know, we're repeat players. You know, we don't want our clients to be repeat players,
right.
But you know, we as the lawyers are repeat players, especially in this world here in Washington D.C. and with, you know, with Maine Justice and some of these other agencies. And so Allison is absolutely right. It's critical not only for this case, but I want to build trust and earn credibility from the government for future cases. And the way I conduct myself in this case is going to benefit not only me, but my other clients, you know, a year from now, 5 years from now, because I've built a relationship with people at DOJ or SEC or whatever, where they know that, you know, they could trust what I say. If I don't know the answer, I'm going to tell them I don't know, and I'm going to figure it out. And if there's a problem, you know, I'm going to talk with them about the problem and why there's a problem. And that's absolutely something that you have to keep in mind, because it is a repeat player business.
And Allison, now sort of moving into newer technology, as you're well aware, I focus a good deal of time professionally on the advancement of search and retrieval technology, and lawyers have been very slow at times to adopt these techniques, despite a tremendous amount of evidence that human review based on limiting keyword searches, which pick up a tremendous amount of garbage, keyword searches, because they pick up a tremendous amount of garbage, are very inefficient.
Mm-hmm.
So are agencies any different from this, or given the advantages that controlling the process confers and being more centralized than law firms, do agencies have an advantage with adopting newer search techniques?
I think the once again, not speaking for the agencies, I think
mm-hmm.
I think, you know, there is an advantage for any large organization to figure out how to most efficiently find and then mine the data and the information. And I think it has been shown that keywords aren't really all going to be entirely the way to go. You know, it's all different levels of evolution. You know, we went from boxes and paper cuts and colored flags to, you know, being able to search or just even sort by date or by custodian, to then using keywords to email strings, and it continues to evolve. I mean, I think, you know, in a number of years we'll all just think about what we'd like the documents to say, and not instantly they'll pop up on the screen. We won't even have to touch a keyboard. You know, and I think the, like any large organizations, there is definitely a benefit of figuring out how to do that efficiently. As also with any organization, it comes down to resources, and it comes down to, you know, making sure that you have both the funding and the capabilities to utilize those new technologies. So I think it's going to be really interesting to see how it develops across the board.
It's both iterative and Darwin combined.
Anyways, can you imagine what that bumper sticker would look like on the back of a car? It would be like an electronic fish with feet, you know?
All right, Chris, since you practice in front of the agencies, do you see an interest in using newer technology from agencies to make the investigation process more efficient?
Yes, I mean, I'm starting to see that, maybe not coincidentally with Allison's and arrival and others like her, but I'm certainly seeing seeing that from various government agencies. Again, a sophistication level and an interest in going beyond just the usual keyword searches and things like that. That is rapidly on the rise in my view. You know, just looking at the subpoenas and requests for information themselves, which now often have, you know, 5 or 10 pages of rather detailed instructions about ESI and the way the government wants to receive it. There is a whole different level of sophistication out there. And, you know, as we touched on earlier, I think the challenge is going to be, the fact that the law is not always the most forward-looking industry. It's inherently conservative. People get comfortable with things like keywords or like, you know, a real person putting eyes on a document, and it takes a while for some of those ingrained notions to change. And there has to be a comfort level that folks get and companies get and individuals get from, you know, court rulings, from, you know, the way agencies treat some of these approaches to kind of get the stamp of approval, you know, before some of this will really take off. You know, Carl, I know you and others have worked with some judges and some magistrates on these kinds of issues, but really the whole industry, it seems to me, has to move along together in these areas to move it forward. Otherwise people can be kind of nervous about trying something new and maybe it not going well.
And Chris, you mentioned a good point there, and I'll sort of end with this. This is my soapbox issue, so it's hard for me to close it out completely. But, one issue I hear about using conceptual searches, and you pointed out right there, is there's at least a comfort that the parties can agree on keywords, even though, you know, all of us that study this know that keywords are missing so much relevant ESI. Wouldn't an agency want to get to the truth more than use a process which is easier to get parties to agree on? I know that's a simplistic question because, you know, there are obviously resource concerns, but in a general way, you know, Allison, doesn't that seem reasonable to ask that question?
Whether or not
think if we
agency,
can push it along?
Meaning, you know, does an agency want truth over form? I mean,
wasn't the question, damn it.
I'm going to go with yes, once again, not speaking for all the agencies. But, I mean, I think you know, there's an important point there, and it's something that you see consistent, you know, through the whole area of law as well as the marketplace. You know, there are the realities, and figuring out what we can do and what we can't do with resources that we have. There's the high-end car, and then there's the car that just moves. And I think there is definitely an interest, you know, as much as possible to be able to work as efficiently as quickly as possible, because it does distract from the core mission. And at the same time, trying to figure out how to do that. You know, and that's one of the things that we've been talking about, you know, engaging early, engaging honestly, and being an advocate, not just for your side, but for your process, helps raise the level of understanding. And then recognizing that, yeah, there are other tools out there, and there are many creative ways that, you know, people are trying to utilize them and to learn about them. You know, is it all going to look the same? Is e-discovery going to look the same? Is discovery going to look the same, you know, 6-8 months from now, and practices that the agencies are going to have? No. But a lot of it's also going to depend on when you're faced with your core mission, you know, and budget, where are you going to be able to place those resources? That said, there will always be a way to make sure that the public's interest is best served, and you know, we can be creative in how we structure those resources to a certain extent, and making sure that we do fulfill our core mission. But you know, it does take a village, and it is very interesting for me to see, you know, the absolute attention from the highest levels of both the Department of Justice as well as other agencies that electronic discovery and the needs of, as you said, Carl, not just resourcing, but getting at the truth in an efficient way and figuring out how we make sure that it isn't the tail wagging the dog. You know, it has to get back to the merits and the core of the case. And we're not just doing this to figure out what's the latest tool or what's the latest decision we can have written. It's we want to make sure that we're protecting the public and figuring out a way to use the tools that are available as well as the law that's available to help us do that. And I think, you know, folks that help with the education, both of the bench and bar like you, Carl, you know, it's very important. And having this type of dialogue with Chris and with others where it's not in the specific context of a case, you know, helps move that goal along, which is, you know, we all have to figure this out together because we're all just going to, you know, it used to be you die the death of 1,000 paper cuts. Now everybody's just going to be crushed by the latest petabyte unless we figure it all out.
Well, that seems like a good way to end the show. I appreciate both of you joining us here as we continue to evolve iteratively and Darwinistically. Allison and Chris, thanks for both joining us on another ESI Bytes show. It's always a pleasure to have you share your knowledge with us and our listeners, and hopefully we'll be able to do some more shows with you later this year. To the listeners, if you've enjoyed this podcast, I'd encourage you to go to www.esibytes.com with a Y for a complete list of our show. You can also remember our show and website phonetically, as it sounds out, as Easy Bytes of ESI information. So however you choose to remember us, come to ESI Bytes to learn more about eDiscovery before ESI bites you back. This is Carl Shinneman, Director of Legal Analytics and Review from Juranov, wishing you a nice day.